This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering.
What we really need, and I've talked to legislators about this endlessly, is that more money needs to be put out there so that you have beds out there, out in the community.
So some sound there from Sheriff Steve Tompkins as we talk about the intersection of Massachusetts Avenue and Melnea Cass Boulevard. As the Wu administration steps up responses this week, the Supreme Judicial Court ruled the city of Quincy can't stop the rebuilding of the Long Island Bridge, which used to connect to comprehensive services on the island. So the question is, what's working and what's not? With us, interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden and Sue Sullivan, who is the Executive Director of New Market Community Partners and the New Market Business Association. Welcome back to both of you.
Good to see you. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Great to have you here in studio too. So what I want to do, Sue Sullivan, is have you take us there. What would I see right now in the neighborhood?
So right now what you would see is roughly between 125, 175 people every day on the street on Southampton Street. Really not too much on Melnea Cass and Mass Ave. They're on there, but the bulk of them are all day, all night on Southampton Street.
And do I hear you say that with observation or frustration, Sue?
Both. It's observation because what we're seeing is that while Mayor Wu in January put everyone into housing that was in tents. There were 170 people out there, and they were all put into housing. A lot of the people on the street now are new. That the people that were put in housing, a lot of them are still in housing or shelter, but out there now are people coming in from all over, and some because they know that there's open-air drug markets, some because they've heard that we're giving housing if they come, and some because other cities, towns, states have said, go there.
Go there being Boston.
Their services.
All right, I'm going to play a little bit of sound here. We talked with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu here on the show on Monday, and she had said back in May, that she was increasing police presence. She implemented more tent clearing, street clearing. She also increased outreach teams. Here she is with some comments earlier this week.
It is a different set of issues during the summer than in the winter, and our hope is to head into this fall in a different place than we did last fall, which is with nearly 300 tents, really risking a lot in terms of lives and safety in the area. And so every single day we continue to take down tents so that that area is clear and we will not have fortified encampments.
So just briefly, Sue, before I move to the district attorney, do you feel like we will enter fall better off than we were September 2021?
Absolutely. The mayor is correct. They are removing tents as quickly as they are put up. And we are, really hopeful that will continue, and because that was just devastating last year, how that was. We are definitely going to be entering better than we were. And still a lot more needs to be done in terms of getting people into treatment and temporary housing.
And we'll pick up on those interventions in a minute. I want to turn now to Suffolk County DA Kevin Hayden. Here's the question that's on my mind for you. We hear that area referred to as an open-air drug market all the time. Mm-hmm. How can we have an open-air drug market if we know it's an open-air drug market? Why haven't we shut it down?
That's precisely the same question that I have, and I think one that needs to be addressed. We have to face the reality that we have a public health problem down on Mass and Cass, but we also have a public safety problem as well. So it's actually goes beyond the open-air drug market. First of all, we do not want drug dealing going on down there, preying on those who have substance use disorder who are there. And we need to work at and eliminate that. We need to eliminate the drug dealing that is going on down there. And the attendant more serious crime that's also going along with it. Human trafficking, more violent crime, the things that are affecting businesses and community. Violent crime this year down that area is up by about 9% compared to last year. And so that's got to concern everybody. So it's a matter of addressing not just the drug dealing, but all the other more serious crime that goes beyond substance use disorder at the same time.
So who's not getting the job done?
Well, you know, I'm hesitant to say that anyone's not getting the job done. I think that everyone is doing what they can. Arrests are being made down there. We are looking at the people that are dealing the drugs down there. We are looking at the human trafficking situation, the crimes of violence. For people that are arraigned in these matters, one of the things that we have instituted is a stay away order request in court in every single case.
Meaning that it's illegal for them basically to come back down
to
the
come
area.
Back down there. Courts are imposing that that stay away order. And so, you know, we're hopeful and optimistic that's going to help. But I think when it comes to the public safety risk, I think we are addressing it. I mean, I met with some Dudley Street House fire department people the other day, and they talked about the risk to their safety when they have to go in there on an emergency call to save somebody and wade through all those people to get there. And subject themselves to danger as well. We have to address the public safety concern that's going on down there.
And this is the dilemma, and I'm going to stay on it, and not without awareness that this is a complex public health crisis and that one of the changes that the Wu administration has made is focusing on it as a public health crisis rather than a crime crisis. Mm-hmm. And Sue Sullivan, you know, of the New Market Business Association, you yourself said, people have gone into housing, they're staying in housing, we're going to go into this fall better than last fall. But something... We have an open-air drug market with violence and crime. We know it's there, and we can't stop it. Sure. So what is the missing puzzle piece or puzzle pieces, Sue, from your perspective?
So it is a public health hazard, and it is a public safety issue, okay? And the police are making a lot more arrests of the really bad people that are preying on everyone who's at risk down there. But the issue is... You know, from my perspective, I'd love to say, why don't we just stop the open-air drug trade? Just take the drugs away. I know we don't want to criminalize, we don't want to put people in jail, but let's stop the drug trade down there. But the problem is, there's a couple of things, and what I'm told, and this is part of the frustration here, is that, so then you have to have some public health people coming behind saying, okay, why don't you get into treatment? Let's see if we can get you here into the right place for you. And there are not enough treatment facilities. There aren't enough treatment facilities. There's not enough transformative housing. I have spent time, we have a work program that we take a number of people who have lived on the street and are trying to get them into treatment and everything and all. I have spent 3 days, 4 days, trying to get someone into a treatment facility, and there aren't enough available. Mm-hmm. And so
I want to bring that up. When we heard a little bit of sound from Suffolk County Sheriff Steve Tompkins at the beginning of the show, he was with us last September. I think it was the actual day that he raised the proposal, D.A. Hayden, to use the South Bay Center as a treatment and recovery center. I want to play the full clip for you now. Mm-hmm.
What we really need, and I've talked to legislators about this endlessly, is that more money needs to be put out there so that you have beds out there, out in the community, not in a facility like mine. But because there aren't that many beds that can do that, to service that, all we're saying is this is one way that we can address this situation, and it could be a very short-term situation for several individuals or a lot of individuals.
And now I'm going to play a little more sound that we heard from Mayor Wu on Monday about taking time to get things in place before we turn to this idea of the Long Island Bridge.
We're looking to decentralize services too, hoping that Shattuck Hospital will be one key piece of that. That RFP is now available, that the state has released, and that we could potentially relocate or connect the services currently being offered at the Roundhouse to a campus that is set up like that, for example, at the Shattuck, and then put Long Island in as a longer-term piece along with those existing services.
So, D.A. Hayden, I put those two things together for a reason. Mm-hmm. One, we know that at the time Sheriff Tompkins' proposal was controversial, mm-hmm. There was considerable concern that it would, in fact, criminalize addiction, as Sue said, we don't want to do. Mm-hmm. But we also hear Mayor Wu talking about the fact that there is a need to spread out services. There's concern about centralization of what's happening at the Roundhouse Hotel. There was a service center that was closed earlier after multiple stabbings because there was concern about concentration of services in the area. Mm-hmm. Should something like what Sheriff Tompkins proposed be on the table from your perspective to meet this distribution need?
I think every proposal should be on the table, and we have to be willing to look at every single possible solution that's available, and we have to do so in a way that's not politicized and that's not partisan. I mean, I think you heard Sheriff Tompkins say that his proposal was not a long-term one. It was a short-term one so we could get to the long-term one. And I think that he had a good idea there. I agree with everything that was said in Mayor Wu's comment about the longer-term solution. This is a – we need three things here. We need a regional approach to this problem. We need a multidisciplinary approach to this problem that addresses the health crisis down there as well. Our program, Services Over Sentences, is intended to address just that. And we absolutely need decentralization as well. I think the statistics that came out just a short while ago said more than 80% of the people that are there right now actually are not from Boston. So they're coming from all over. They're coming from all over Massachusetts and even from all over New England. We may not have enough and housing and beds and facilities for care and treatment, both short-term and long-term, is absolutely necessary. And we know there's not enough of it in Boston. So that's one of the reasons why decentralization is wanted and needed. There may not be enough locally, but if we spread out to a much further diaspora of the state, I believe that we probably do have the resources and the housing and the beds that we need. And if we take that approach, then maybe we can get people out of there.
We're talking about the current state of the situation in the area that's often called Mass and Cass, Massachusetts Avenue and Melnia Cass Boulevard, where we have a crisis of addiction, people who are unhoused, mental illness, and an open-air drug market. Sue Sullivan, I'll turn back to you now. You represent business interests in the area, and I'm thinking about, you said earlier, okay, so housing's working, except more people are coming, right? And of course, the implication there is that sooner or later we'll run out of housing. And Kevin Hayden just now, DA Hayden, just talked about the need for this regional approach. I'm thinking about Revere pushing back during the attempt to remove tents from the area about bringing any housing or services there. I'm thinking about Quincy fighting it in the courts to get the Long Island Bridge. Tell me what conversation you could have with a compatriot or equivalent of yours in another city or town that would make them say, okay, yes, we will agree to and take some of the services here too.
And actually, it's funny because I actually do speak with a lot of them. We have business improvement districts across the state. There are 10 of them, and we get together frequently. And I think everyone would take a small piece if incentivized to do so. Okay, I think right now it's that fear factor. Everyone, when you talk to someone, and not these downtown business improvement districts because they are open to it, but you talk to your average citizen on the street from other places, and they're like, oh, don't bring the Mass and Cass down here. It's been so publicized and so many pictures of what it looks like when you have 150 people on the street that is all people think about. But what they don't think about is you could have a 20-bed treatment facility in your town, or you could have a 2-3-deckers of transformative housing in your neighborhood, and that's not going to turn into a Mass and Cass. And that's really the big issue. And so somewhere along the way, whether it's the governor convening a symposium of all of the elected officials and all from the other areas and Boston and say, look, how are we going to treat this? How are we going to bring it together so that everyone takes a piece? Because I will tell you that on those streets right now, out of those 150, 175, there are 20 from Quincy, 20 from West Roxbury, 50 from Springfield. They are
those are example numbers. You don't
I'm not saying actual numbers. You know, 7 from Dover. You know, I mean, I'm just saying
proportionally
they are from all over the place.
Well, and you mentioned Springfield, and I do want to note, as of May, per some Boston Globe reporting, the state approved 12 new housing contracts for 298 more single occupancy units from Springfield to Lawrence. So turning back to you, District Attorney Kevin Hayden, Sue Sullivan just said small size and the proper incentives. So let's fill in the blank. The proper incentives are X and Y.
So the proper incentives are for the people down there we're talking about, or for where they're going to go? So the proper incentives for the people
for the communities to participate regionally in a solution.
Yeah, I think slightly outside my scope, but I think the proper incentives is just what Sue is talking about. It's a realization, understanding that this is a collective problem that we all need to address. We all need to do a small part. If you break those 150 or 170 people up and spread them out over a diaspora, I think it's easier to handle. It's easier to treat. What we have right now down there, and that's where our services over census approaches, is you throw chum in the water, the sharks are going to come, right? So when you talked about the drug dealers and the crime down there, if you have a bunch of people who have substance use disorders all in one place at one time, if you don't deal with that and help and deal with that health issue, you're not going to be able to deal with the drug dealing and the other crime issue, because it's going to go there. It's going to go to where they're going to go, where the business is, right?
So underscoring that one more time then, is there anybody who has not stepped up and taken responsibility that needs to? Or is it just that we aren't doing enough? Sue?
So when you say who hasn't stepped up, I would say other cities and towns need to step up. Okay, and I know Mary Lou Sutters, who's the Secretary of Health and Human Services and off of the state, they are working very hard to place treatment facilities and to place housing in different areas. And when you talk about incentivizing, whether we incentivize these communities with dollars, if you're not incentivizing, you're penalizing.
Got it.
And, you know, one way or the other. But I'll tell you, the businesses down there right now, we've got 20,000 people working down there, and they all come from the neighborhoods right around that area, the most economically challenged neighborhoods. And these businesses, these employees are trying to go to work every day, and it's really difficult. The residents that live there, they can't use their parks. It's really hard.
All right. That is Sue Sullivan, Executive Director of Newmark Community Partners and the Newmarket Business Association, and Interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden, both here in Studio 2. Always a pleasure to have you. I appreciate you both coming in.
Good to see you. Thanks.
Thank you.
So I read on the internet that cats get on your laptop because they're mirroring you. And so if you get them their own laptop, they'll leave you alone. And look at this little businessman!
Okay, it is a week of hard news, so let's lighten things up a little bit. And they dared me to do it, so ready? Here we go. Go get Socks, Whiskers, and Simba, and put your thinking cats on. Radio Boston is not kitten around. It's Ask the Vets, cat edition, and it's going to be positively perfect. I did it. I did the puns. So joining us now to answer our questions and yours about your feline friends are Indu Mani, veterinarian at VCA Brookline Animal Hospital and chief scientific officer at Brief Media, which creates clinical content for vets. And also with us here in studio, Monica Mansfield, veterinarian at Medway Animal Hospital and the president-elect of the Massachusetts Veterinary Medicine Association. Ooh, we got some sound there from you on the line, Indu. Indu and Monica, welcome back. It's been a minute.
Thank you so much for having us here. What a delight. Thank you.
It's great to have you here again. And Indu, how are you?
I'm doing great, Tiziana and Monica. It's so great to hear your voices.
It's great to be with you both. And listen, we have some questions already from our texting group. But if you're listening live right now, you can tweet them in. We'll be paying attention. And if you're in the texting group, go ahead and send additional questions in. If we can get to them, we will. So, Monica, you brought a picture of Indu, and Indu is with her dog. Are either of you cat people?
Oh, yeah.
This is Monica. Go ahead, Monica.
I have three cats at home right now, and one's a big old timer that had a really scary, within the week ago, he had an abscess that blew up the side of his face, and he's very not a good surgical candidate because he's got everything wrong with him, but we had to do an emergency surgery, and now a week later, he's the sweetest, kindest, you know, doing all these things of knocking things off the counter, being trouble again, so we know he's feeling better. And then two other cats at our house there.
And poor guy, for people who don't know, an abscess is basically a giant pus pocket, right?
Yeah, that's
nasty.
A good way to put it. That's a very and the word we use when we're writing it down is purulent.
There, that's a good word. I'm going to have to find a way to use that. Indu, do you also have a cat in your life?
No, I'm embarrassed to say I am allergic to cats. And there are more of us that are.
Should you have to be embarrassed about an allergy?
I am embarrassed because I made a career move that was, inscrutable career move to many. But I don't have one at home. It's always a regret because they're so amazing. And I have to say, and Monica, I don't know if you feel this way, but I feel that, you know, people always talk about your patients teaching you. And I think I've learned more from cats than from dogs or from any other patients. They're enigmatic creatures. They're incredible. They're not direct. So you really have to think about what they're trying to tell you.
Okay. So, we're going to talk about the challenges of treating cats, the joys of having cats, and I want to bring a lot of listener voices in here. So I'm going to start right away with that. We invited our texting group to send in thoughts on this. And remember, you can join our texting group by sending the word Boston to 617-766-0382. And if you missed that number, you can find it on the About page of our website. I want to start with some art, actually, that we received. Radio Boston listener Nancy in Cambridge shared some original cat haiku. And one leads perfectly into a question we had. So here's Nancy reading some haiku written from the perspective of her cat, Anna.
Someday you will pay for the tricks you make me do to earn a greenie. And if I were huge, I would proudly carry you, neck crushed in my jaws.
So Monica, as an owner of three cats, we hear some cat owners express concern that perhaps their cats don't actually love them, but just find them convenient.
Well,
what's up?
You know, I think they all have their own temperament, but yeah, I think it's a well established, probably truth that cats, you know, we're kind of in their space, and when they want to come to us, that they will, and that we kind of have to earn it. And I think, you know, we probably can never change that. I think it may be partly how they developed, or it might be part of their why they can be so wily. But I think that they're secretive, and we get to earn them.
So we are talking to Drs. Monica Mansfield, who you just heard, and Dr. Indu Mani. It's Ask the Vets About Cats here on Radio Boston today as we look for a break from all the big news stories of the week. Indu Mani, my understanding is that, and I should say this before I raise this question, I should say you have no idea the grief I have taken from the team this week for being so pro-dog, right? And we're doing this cat segment. So let me just confess to that as we start. Indu Mani, my understanding is that cats' brains are actually structured differently than dogs' brains.
Yeah, they were domesticated later than dogs. There's some data out there, and there continues to be emerging, you know, phenomenal evaluation of how they domesticate, how cats were domesticated. Their brains, they are different. They have, I'll be perfectly honest that I don't remember the actual neuroanatomy from vet school from a very long time ago. But in the clinical setting, we definitely stratify the needs of our patients, cats versus dogs. And what we might say a dog needs, and when I counsel my clients, is very different from the needs that you have to meet in a cat. So absolutely, functionally, their brains are different. They eat differently. They sleep differently. They interact differently, and not like a human. And they're not the easy, a lot of people think cats are just these easy, effort-free pets. That's just not true. And if you're not putting the effort into care, to giving your cat what it needs, you have to make changes to try to do that.
So I want to pick up on that thread, this idea of the differences. And one of the questions that came in, Monica Mansfield, was one of our texters, Dottie in Mount Juliet, asked, do inside living cats need to be seen by a veterinarian on a regular basis like dogs do? Our cats have been inside since they were adopted 6 years ago. They seem to be thriving, you know, sleeping, eating, and the occasional zoom zooms.
Great question, and we get that a lot, but I would advise that they come in at least once a year. Certainly we, in our state, we are required to have up-to-date rabies vaccines for all animals, whether they're indoor or outdoor. That comes every 3 years once we get the rabies vaccines established properly. But aside from that, the once a year annual visits can be really helpful because 1 year in their life is like us not going to see our doctor for 6 or 7 years.
And really,
sometimes, you know, what we're doing in the exam is not always obvious, but as Dr. Mani Indu, as you know, there's so much that we see just by watching the patient. When I see a cat come in, as they come out of their carrier, you know, I'm using a lot of my observational skills as to how comfortable that cat is. And because they're so kind of stealth and secretive, they're known for hiding illnesses that they might have for, you know, a good month or 2 months from us. So besides watching how they breathe and their presence, how they are, we're looking at their gum color, checking their ears. One of the biggest things is when we listen to their heart. And cats can have a heart murmur that we don't know about from the outside, because when cats do have heart disease, you almost never know about it in advance until it's, you know, kind of further down the road. But other things too on the exam, we're feeling their belly, making sure there are no masses. Are their kidneys a normal size? We check their skin, see if their secretive little feet have had anything going on, sometimes the underside of their feet. So during a thorough exam once a year, we're checking for all these hidden things that cats are never going to tell us about.
So that is so much, right? And this is Radio Boston, and we're doing a special Ask the Vet on cats after some requests from listeners to do so. So you were just hearing from Dr. Monica Mansfield there, who's a veterinarian at Medway Animal Hospital. We also have with us Dr. Indu Mani, who's a veterinarian at the VCA Brookline Animal Hospital. And so, Dr. Indu Mani, are there typical illnesses that you're looking for in cats? Like, are there some greatest hits that are most likely to be what you're seeing?
Yeah, there definitely are. And very quickly, I just wanted to, Monica was mentioning the rabies vaccines. We see cats all the time, indoor cats, where in their homes that bats come into the homes.
Oh.
And you know, they can be a pure indoor cat, but if they're not up to date on rabies vaccines and they're bitten by a rabid bat, that can be really devastating. So
that's scary for people too. I
yes,
mean, anybody,
yeah,
anybody.
Exactly.
You have now given me a new night terror.
No, I don't want to give you night terror. But yes, there are greatest hits and that we see in cats. And Monica will know that with geriatric cats, we've got the trifecta of kidney disease, thyroid disease, inflammatory bowel disease, and quadrifecta and diabetes mellitus. Those are things that we see often in geriatric and aged cats. And the truth is that the more work that we do, seeing cats on a regular basis, monitoring weight trends, monitoring appetite, the subtle things that owners might notice, we can pick these things up early and we can really manage them quite well. With younger cats, there are things that will happen if a cat is outdoors versus if a cat is indoors. Monica described this abscess. That's something we see commonly in outdoor cats who hunt and fight. And with indoor cats, we're seeing what I kind of think is an epidemic of anxiety-based behaviors in cats. And when a cat urinates outside the litter box, especially a younger cat, it's almost never due to urinary tract infection with bacteria.
Why would you think there would be an epidemic of anxiety in cats? And I ask this with seriousness. Why would that be?
I think I have my own theories, and I have some friends, some veterinarians. We've all discussed this. I definitely think having people at home more during the pandemic kind of reshifted the dynamic in the home for already established cats. Concomitantly, when cats who were brought into the home during the pandemic got used to having a certain level of engagement from their family members and people are going back to work, that can cause it. And I think simmering in the background here is the need to make sure that all people are meeting what their cats need, because as Monica said, they are secretive, they're enigmatic, they don't tell you things directly. It's up to us to kind of make sure we're reading what they're trying to tell us.
So I want to pick up on that. You used as an example, Dr. Mani, the fails with a litter box. So Monica Mansfield, veterinarian at Medway Animal Hospital, let me turn back to you. What are the typical litter box fails, and what are the typical solutions for those?
Well, Well, our official term is inappropriate urination and defecation, but basically peeing outside the box. And sometimes it's in a shoe. I once had a very naughty cat named Amos that I was at the time renting a house from a construction worker, and the cat peed all over the blueprints for the house building. And it was, you know, there can be the most inappropriate places to be. But it is one of our most common problems that we see. And, you know, I always tell people that it can be that there's a physical problem, that there might be a urinary tract infection, but it also could be all, you know, a lot of emotional. And if there is a urinary tract infection, that can lead to it becoming emotional. But I kind of have like a litter box Zen recommendations. First of all, though, I would say it would warrant an exam with your veterinarian, because they'll probably check a urine sample, make sure there's not a problem there, and talk over whether there are any health or pain issues. But litter box Zen rules for cats that are kind of finicky about their box: it can be because they're having another cat taunt them. If there's any interactions within the house, we want to make sure that there's enough real estate in the boxes so that there's a lot of room and
in the litter boxes.
Yeah. So I always recommend to give more than just a standard cat litter box. If you get an underbed sweater box that you can get at, you know, any of the Target, or that is made for storing sweaters under the bed, nice big and wide, so they've got room to move around. And then other boxes, too. They can all be side by side. The standard recommendation is a box per cat plus one. But if you have a long and wide, and then one or two other, if you have multiple cats in the house, that can be very helpful. So that's one. Don't cover the box. Don't have any liners. Cats don't like crinkly things. And a lot of times cats can be very tactile sensitive. Think about it. The humans, like, who don't like tags or ponytails, you know, that's more the tactile
because
cat.
Because of the way they touch them.
Yeah. Yeah. So the litter itself should be as close to Miami sand as it can, like really soft litter that doesn't have big granules and doesn't have an odor. So non-scented litter all the time, I would say, always, always. Honestly, I don't like most of the regular store brand ones. The granules are too big. They don't clump well enough. There are a couple brands that I like a lot. I don't know if I can say them on the air or not.
I don't know that.
Okay, so I won't.
Yes.
But anyhow.
You can tweet them.
I'll tweet them. Oh, that sounds good. Yeah. But the idea is to have them, ones that form a clump well, and then scoop once or twice a day. If you have a cat that tends towards the peeing outside the box, make sure that the box is as friendly as possible.
All right, so I have one last question. I'll turn to Indumani for this. We've got about a minute left here. This is a mental health question. Liam in Jamaica Plain texted, is it really as dangerous as a lot of people claim for house cats to go outdoors? We adopted a neutered cat when he was 4 and was apparently used to going outside. He scratches at the door and bangs around the house until he's let out. He doesn't stay out long, but seems to benefit from the outdoor time. So briefly, what about letting the indoor cats outdoors?
You know, cats are meant to you know, exhibit their catness by running around outdoors. That's absolutely true. And we kind of are in this liminal space, keeping cats indoors to keep them safe and have long lives. So it's definitely something that you'd think about in terms of animal welfare. Are we doing the right thing? I would say absolutely. If it's causing a lot of discord in the house, and Liam, if your kitty is getting agitated, it's okay. It's okay to let it outdoors if there's no other choice. What I would say is make sure it's up to date on a feline leukemia vaccine. Make sure it has all its front claws. Make sure that that it's getting dewormed and getting flea and tick treatment.
So give it the resources it needs, but then okay.
Yeah,
all right.
Exactly.
Veterinarians Indu Mani of VCA Brookline Animal Hospital and Monica Mansfield of Medway Animal Hospital. This was a fun Ask the Vets on cats. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Over the weekend, for the second time this month, white supremacists marched in Boston. Here's Mayor Michelle Wu talking to Radio Boston about it on Monday.
We see a surge nationally of white supremacy and hate, and the efforts to target what amount to domestic terrorism still are falling on the shoulders of states and municipalities.
U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins played for the state and local team as Suffolk County District Attorney and now represents the federal government that Mayor Wu told us she wants more from. Rachel Rollins joins us on the line. USA Rollins, welcome back.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you. So we got a little background sound there. I'm sure we'll get that taken care of. And while you do, my first question to you, reactions to what you just heard Mayor Wu say in that cut.
We are lucky to have leadership like Mayor Wu in Boston and in our Commonwealth. And I agree 100% with her. We have to be incredibly mindful and proactive regarding this type of hate that we've seen people emboldened to engage in. And I am ready, willing, and able to assist as the chief federal law enforcement officer for our Commonwealth, and was actively involved in this work when I was the elected district attorney of Suffolk County, which is Boston, Chelsea, Winthrop, and Revere from 2019 to 2022.
So do you agree that too much responsibility for intelligence, response, tracking, solutions has fallen on local authorities? Have we had an insufficient federal response?
I don't believe so. I believe we can be doing more. And I think with respect to the special agent in charge of the FBI, Bonavalenta, and myself, chief federal law enforcement officer here, we have been very actively involved. I have the privilege of having worked with the city of Boston many, many times and know many of the actors there. But I also made sure that after having a meeting with about 70 stakeholders regarding what occurred on July 4th weekend,
The Patriot Front March.
That's absolutely right. I then made sure that I went out and met with the mayors of Malden and Melrose to speak with them about what it is that we knew. We also had the chief of the MBTA police with us at that meeting, a very small meeting to discuss how we could react moving forward. And we are always open to hearing ways that we can improve, but I am deeply committed to making sure that there is a federal response here. Additionally, we saw, Tiziana, that back on, I believe, June 11th, 31 members of Patriot Front were arrested in Idaho. I've been in contact with my counterpart, my peer, the U.S. attorney out in Idaho, as to what is happening there. So we are looking on a national scope as to what's happening here. I have the privilege of serving as the vice chair of the Civil Rights Committee for all United States attorneys across the country. My chair is Nicholas Brown, who's the U.S. attorney out in the state of Washington. But he and I are working tirelessly to make sure we are aware of what is happening across the country, and then certainly just within our own individual states.
We were talking about responses to white supremacy in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts with Rachel Rollins, who is the U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. You know, in your dashboard, and we've talked before here on the show about what your big priorities as U.S. attorney are, in your dashboard of the things that get the most attention and most mind share and most monitoring from you, where does this rank?
This is absolutely one or two for me. And what I can tell you is when I became the elected district attorney, you know, I knew there was hate in the world, but I had no idea the level of hate there was. Remember, as DA, we had the horrific murders of Ramona Cooper and David Green from Nathan Allen and Winthrop. That was, according to the ADL and also according to me in law enforcement, a hate crime murder by Nathan Allen, who had a manifesto that made it very clear his hatred of Jewish people and his hatred of Black people in particular. We also saw the stabbing of a rabbi by an individual that my office immediately charged and then increased to a hate crime. But as U.S. Attorney, Tiziano, I have seen just a real significant uptick in anti-Semitism and anti-LGBTQ community hate that we've seen. We've seen burnings of Jewish assisted living facilities that we prosecuted an individual federally for. We've seen threats against a dictionary company, Webster Dictionary, which is located in our Commonwealth, somebody calling about the definition of a woman and sort of gender definitions there, made some significant threats that had to have that work location evacuated based on the hateful and threatening calls that were made. We are no longer waiting, or will never wait, until actual violence occurs if people are using words that are threats. So, for example, when we see what happened in Hyde Park at the facility, the Pride facility that is going, that is being built in this moment for senior LGBTQ members, when you use words like die by fire or, you know, kill.
And this was graffiti on the Pride facility on their signs.
Absolutely. I have made clear to both the commissioner of the Boston Police Department, as well as the special agent in charge of the FBI, that is a threat. Hard stop.
So we actually brought you a little bit of sound from that. We talked with, we had had Gretchen Van Ness, who's the executive director of LGBTQ Senior Housing, on announcing the Pride, and then talked with Gretchen after that act of vandalism. Here's a little bit.
It was every single sign that we had put up for our historic groundbreaking. And the words were just cruel and frightening, threatening to burn our building down, threatening to kill us. And I thought, I've never seen anything so horrible.
So it's striking to me, USA Rollins, that she's echoing sort of the intensity in what she saw and the differentness of it from what you saw. And you and I, over the last couple of years, have talked a lot about racism, anti-blackness, the surge in activity there. Now we're talking about really extreme approaches to intimidation and harassment of the LGBTQ plus community. I guess I want to ask you, you refer to yourself as the sort of the chief law enforcement officer for the federal government here in Massachusetts. Are vulnerable people in the Commonwealth safe?
We are doing everything to make sure that they are, and they certainly have every right, though, to feel fear, right? When somebody makes clear that we want to burn this to the ground, we want to kill you, that doesn't leave anything to the imagination. We are actively looking for who these individuals are, and whether they are adults or whether they are juveniles. Certainly if they're juveniles, that will likely be handled by a district attorney's office or maybe the attorney general's office, but likely the DA's office. If they're adults, we'll be looking to see whether there are federal charges that can be brought. But we aren't, what I want people to hear is the DAs, the 11 DAs, the attorney general of our Commonwealth, Maura Healey, as well as myself, the United States Attorney, the Chief Federal Law Enforcement Officer, AG Healey is the Chief State Law Enforcement Officer. We are all working together. And what we don't want to do is have anything, you know, fall through the cracks, right? The LGBTQ community deserves to be safe and feel protected by their federal, state, and local government partners. And, you know, I've made a statement, Tiziana, that I, you know, everyone deserves to live free of fear and authentically as who they are. And yes, the First Amendment exists, and we are going to make sure that people are able to, even if it's opinions that we find repugnant, they are entitled to that. But when you cross that line into threats of harm, that is it. We are going to hold you accountable at the federal level or at the state or local level. Period. End of story.
A little bit more of your statement, and I know I'm quoting you back to you, but for listeners, quote, every single person has a right to live their life fully and authentically as who they are. But if your authentic self is a bigot that wants to harm, humiliate, and terrorize people, you are not welcome here. There is no hierarchy as to who is entitled to a full and authentic life, end quote. So I am actually going to pick that up with a little bit more sound from our conversation with Boston Mayor Michelle Wu, and this was in reference to the Patriot Front March that you mentioned from over the July 4th weekend. Here is Mayor Wu one more time.
We rely on our federal partners to provide that information to us to the extent that they are monitoring and watching for these behaviors and the connection to Boston. But we need more from them as well. We need to have a greater focus nationally on how these groups can be tracked and monitored and categorized as verging on domestic terrorism.
So I'm picking that up for the words information, tracked, and monitored, because you announced on Sunday the intention to open a hotline to have people call in for white supremacy. And I'm going to ask you a compound question here. One, what do you hope to accomplish with that hotline? And two, there will be those who say that is government surveillance and it is scary. And I want you to kind of respond to both of those, please.
Yeah, so the mayor's right. We need to make sure that we're speaking to each other about what is happening, that we're looking at trends. The FBI has made clear, we do not surveil people based on their ideology. We do not do that. That is, people have constitutional rights, as I said earlier, with respect to the First Amendment. However, what I want to do with this dedicated number, which I'm hoping within the next 24 or so hours to possibly announce what that number is, if we can, or certainly I hope by the end of this week or early next week, is give people the opportunity, if they do not feel comfortable calling the tips line for the Boston police, or they do not feel comfortable calling 1-800-CALL-FBI, which is a number that you can call with respect to the FBI. My line is dedicated exclusively to hate, not necessarily any of the other general things that people might call the BPD tips line on or the FBI. And what I want to accomplish is people who have real deep concerns or are fearful regarding information they have.
Can you give us an example of what you might expect in one of those calls?
Sure. So I was going to say there are two buckets of people. There could be somebody that, you know, we would prefer that they call 911, but if they aren't comfortable to say, hey, look, I just was watching TV and the person that was arraigned that I saw on TV, I have information that I saw them doing something 3 weeks ago that was deeply troubling to me, right? I saw them either, you know, with swords and shields moving into this, you know, storage facility and you pushed a person to the ground, right? If they don't feel comfortable calling 911 about that, you know, there are some individuals, Tiziana, unfortunately, that they see something and they aren't comfortable saying it. If they have this call and say, well, wait a minute, now that I know that this person's been charged with respect to an incident that was based in hate, you know, in Hyde Park, I'm going to make this phone call to that number. That's number one. But number two, I want to bring all of our attention to the Washington mother. Her name is Nicole Schubert. There, in the last couple of days, there was a sort of alert regarding her name. She brought to the attention of the police back in 2019 that her son, she found his manifesto, and essentially he had threatened to kill her as well as several other of his schoolmates. And she made the very hard choice of reporting her son to the police. There are some people that might not feel comfortable calling the police on a loved one or a friend. This number, you can make phone calls and we'll make sure we get that to the right federal, state, or local partners, law enforcement partners, to make sure that they're doing wellness checks or looking into people in those circumstances.
Okay, so we've got 30 seconds left in the show. One word answer, just so we know, is the hotline anonymous?
It can be anonymous, or you can leave your name as well. But we would need a lot more information, as much as you felt comfortable, if it was going to be anonymous. But yes, just like the tips line and just like 1-800-CALL-FBI, anonymous.
U.S. Attorney for the District of Massachusetts, Rachel Rollins, always good to have you. Thank you.
Take care.
And that's our show for today. Tune in again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.